This week's show with Shirley Pigott is sponsored by the Embroiderers Guild of America at egausa.org. These days, the list of events and activities being offered by the EGA is long and rich with opportunity. One series of events is the regional seminars, which give you a chance to attend a live event that is likely close to home. This year's schedule includes the Sun Region Retreat called Fee-Fi-Fo-Fun, April 29 to May 1 in Howie in the Hills, Florida, and registration for that ends March 15, so you'll want to get right on that. Then we have the Mid-Eastern Region Workshop called Little Stitches 2022. That is now September 16 and 17 in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. It is postponed from the April 29 to May 1 original dates. The Rocky Mountain Region Seminar, Rocky Mountain Roundup, is May 19 to 21 in Denver. The South Central Region Seminar, Crew of Needle and Thread, is June 14 to 18 in Shreveport, Louisiana. The Mid-Atlantic Region Seminar, Waves of Stitches, is June 15 to 19 in Norfolk, Virginia. Heartland Region Seminar, A Stitch for All Seasons, June 16 to 19 in Minnetonka, Minnesota. The Tennessee Valley Region Seminar, called Stitching Friends Forever, is June 24 to 26 in Kingsport, Tennessee. The Greater Pacific Region Seminar, Stitching in the Rogue, July 8 to 13 in Ashland, Oregon. And then, of course, the crown jewel is the EGA National Seminar, Broadway Bound, August 24 to 28 in New York City. Consider attending a regional seminar and definitely put the EGA National Seminar on your schedule. Also, consider joining EGA so you can take advantage of all that the organization has to offer. And now, on to our show with Shirley Pigott. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week from New Zealand, Shirley Pigott. Shirley, welcome.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks for having me.
All right, now I got to practice that name, Pigott. Pigott?
That's right.
Pigott.
Yep.
There. Better.
Okay. Well done.
I don't have the accent. That's the fun part about the folks from your end of the world is we get to listen to the accents, so that's good.
Yes, yeah.
All right, now, immediately, I'm a fan of you because you'll do just about any technique. So
pretty much.
I'm all in with you. Yeah, all in.
Yes. I'm not so good at the things that require accurate counting. For that, I really have to concentrate. So I don't do as much counted work as other things. I tend to do it if I have to, but not for fun. Never for fun.
That's interesting because you hear that from time to time. Yeah, I don't do the counted thing because I'm terrible at it. And I don't have a problem with it. But so there's a number of people who just, yeah, counting for them is just more trouble than it's worth. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard.
Yep.
And I like it. And I like it that you don't just do the techniques, but you take them in your own direction. I think that is what's cool.
Yes, I'm not a purist, partly because I've taught myself a lot of the initial things. So when you teach yourself, there's no rules. You can do it whatever way makes sense. So for me, that's just kept going. I tend to just see things that I want to do or techniques that I like and mix them with other things, whether or not it's the normal way of doing things. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, that's where the art comes in. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, and the challenge, and for me, that's the enjoyable part, is making things work like that.
Yeah. All right. See, because we've talked several times, Beth and I have had many discussions with people where we talk about playing and answering the question, what if? And so that willingness or that lack of knowledge about how to do it, you know, the quote right way, just to me, there's a freedom there that you gain out of that.
Yes. And it's also part of where I live, here, where for years we didn't have necessarily the right materials, the right things, and everything, not just in embroidery. So you have to be innovative. You figure out a way to make it work. In New Zealand, they call it the number eight wire mentality. Number eight wire is what they use to make fences. And so you can make anything out of fence wire if you try hard enough, with that kind of thinking. And then that sort of, for me, that overflows into what I do, because you know, if you haven't got what you need, or you haven't got the technique you need, you just figure out a way to make it go, to make it work.
I love that. Number eight wire. I'm stuck. Get some number eight wire. You can fix it.
Pretty much, yeah. A little bit like MacGyver's duct tape. You know, it's the same kind of thinking.
Yeah. What's the needlework world? Now, we've talked to people in Australia, and there's a strong community of needle artists in Australia. Is it equal in New Zealand or less so? What's that like?
It's pretty strong. I can't compare completely with Australia because I haven't been there. And Australia, the whole country works differently. We're like one state. Rather, they've got, you know, a number of states, and each one is different. But we've got a very strong national organisation, and we have guilds that are associated with that. And I'm not sure of the number, but there are, you know, it's a strong membership. An active membership too, so it's good. Outside of that, I'm not so sure. I've had a little bit of contact with groups that are outside of that, but my main contact is through the New Zealand guilds.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, teaching and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, because I mean, it's one of the things that I've enjoyed talking, particularly with Australian people, and looking at the design work, is there's a real melting pot of cultures that reflects a lot of, you know, in different ways with different artists. And I just enjoy that. And I assume you get a lot of that too in New Zealand.
Yes, we do. And from what I've seen, and again, my experience is quite limited with what happens in Australia, but in New Zealand, there's a huge emphasis on original design.
Oh.
For instance, we have national exhibitions, and there are categories that are only for original work, and that's the emphasis. You can't enter something you've done in a class or done from a kit or a book in a national competition. You're not allowed to. It has to be original. You can at a regional level, but not at national level. So it's only original work. So there's a huge emphasis on that, and I believe in Australia, that's not the case. They do have categories for work at state level that are, you know, done from kits or classes, but for here, you can't.
Wow. We try that here, Beth. We try that here in the States. There'd be no entries.
That's right. There wouldn't be. I mean, EGA does that. That's that fiber forum thing that we saw. And you saw that was, I mean, there's a few entries there. But like ANG, the American Needlepoint Guild, they have a lot of different categories. But most people enter like a painted canvas with a stitch guide with a few variations by the stitcher. It's mainly or a kit, or there are some original works in there. But from what I've seen, there are not that many. And they're mainly by designers.
Oh, well, we don't have a lot of designers here, so it's mainly just individuals, some experienced, some not so, but yeah, there's a very strong emphasis on that.
Is that what drove you? That becomes a culture thing. So you really, you know, I say drove you to be a designer. You didn't really have an option.
Partly, but I've always done my own thing when I was little. When I didn't really do embroidery when I was little, particularly. I did all sorts of crafts, but I never followed the instructions very well, and I always sort of used it as a starting point, not an end point. So I've always done that, and according to my mother, made huge amounts of mess to go with it, and didn't require any help. So I've always had very strong views about what I wanted to do and how I wanted to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't worry about it looking like someone else's. that's never bothered me. When I started embroidery, that just continued. I'm sort of driven to create my own versions of things, my own designs. I can't help myself.
That's such, but yeah, that's, see, that's so neat because that's such a hard shell for people to break and just say, you know, I want to do my own thing. It's to break out of that comfort zone of executing what others have created. And so you right out of the gate, you were just your own person doing your own thing. And not, okay.
Yes, yes. And part of that was driven by the fact that you couldn't get the same things. You know, if you can't, I've taught people who, if they can't get exactly the right number thread that you use and exactly the same fabric, they're not happy. Whereas I never had that. You looked at what was used and thought, oh, well, I've got something that looks a bit like that. That'll do. And you just sort of go from there. So I've always done that.
Hmm. Oh.
Well, so it's more of that mentality. It's more of that mentality of making do with what you have, too.
Yeah. Interesting.
The sound's gone funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, it's about that playing and that what if that you were talking about before. What if you do it this way? Does it actually matter if it doesn't work? What do you learn by something not working? It's that sort of thinking rather than putting pressure on yourself to get it exactly right or exactly the way it should be. Mm-hmm. It's a whole mindset.
Yeah. It says here that in my research of you that you started knitting when you were 4 years old.
Yes, I did. I knitted. My mother still got the
Your
the
mother
outfit.
Allowed you to have needles as a four-year-old?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I was doing embroidery on sacking cloth when I was five, so it's a natural progression.
Yeah.
But yes, I loved knitting, and that was actually my first love, and I did that for probably, 20, 25 years, but I ended up with a problem with my wrist, which meant that knitting became very uncomfortable and difficult. So then I had to find something else. So that's really where where the needles came in, because it didn't hurt my hand to do it, you see.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. When you start that young and you do it all those years, yeah, that's a lot of repetition. Yeah.
Mm.
So then you go to, that's right. I had to ask you when oven clothes, you sewed oven clothes? What? I
don't, cloths.
Cloths.
So,
oh.
Potatoes would come in a sack. And then when the potatoes were all used up, you would take the sack and you would put a drawing on it. Now, usually that came from a coloring book. Mm-hmm. So we would draw it in, like greaseproof paper. And you would put it on the sacking and then you would tack it just the way that you would now for an embroidery, except on a slightly bigger scale. And then I would stitch it with wool. So I've actually got three that I stitched because I used to give them to my grandmothers, my aunties. And my grandmother liked them so much, she didn't really like to use them. So she kept them. And I've got the first one I did and one of the last ones I did. And it's really interesting to see the complexity. I really went a bit to town with the last one. I mean, it's got so much stitching on it. I could see why she didn't want to use it. My mother finished them. You know, she backed them with some cotton fabric or something like that. And then you use it to get hot things in and out of your oven.
Oh, okay. All right.
Mm.
Wow. It's just so neat that you grew up doing all that.
Yeah.
And then you just carried that right through school then. You never stopped.
Yes. No, I never stopped. I always had to be doing something. My favorite things were craft books that you sort of how to, you know, encyclopedias that would tell you how to do this or how to do that. And I would just kind of dive in there and do things. So I tried an awful lot of different things. Clay, what do you call it? Copper, metal, where you push shapes out and make patterns on it, knitting, sewing, you name it, I tried it, if I could get my hands on the materials to do it.
Were you that kid in school who was always the go-to artist person?
No, because I wasn't an artist. I was a crafter.
Okay.
Rather than an artist, I couldn't even draw that well. So I never considered myself as an artist.
Hmm. Yet you created all kinds of things. Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. Okay. That's interesting. Because that's art. I mean, to me.
Yes.
It's just not drawing and painting. Yeah.
It is. But 40 years ago, 50 years ago, it wasn't really. Art was done with paint and paper, and I didn't do that.
Yeah. Well, they were wrong. So how's that?
Yeah, fair enough.
They were wrong. And then the turning it from what I read, the turning point was when you, for you in a big way, was when you tripped over Jane Nicholas's stump work embroidery book.
Yes, it was the collection of fruits, flowers, and insects, the one with the frame.
Yes.
Of stump
I have that
work.
Book. Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I saw that, and I was sort of at a loose end because I couldn't do the knitting anymore, and I didn't have much money, and I also had tried a bit of painting, and I wasn't really satisfied. And I found that book, and I just thought it was the most wonderful thing I'd ever seen. And so I started playing around with what was there, but of course, not following the instructions properly, just doing my own thing.
Nice book, Jane, but I got my own way.
Well, I mean, her instructions were so good that you could follow, and what was there, and then change it to whatever you had. So I did that for a couple of years, and I really wanted to know more, but I didn't know what was around. And I found it was actually an international stitching conference that was being held in Auckland in 2000. It was called Embroidery 2000. And I thought, yes, I'm going to do this. I'm going to find care for my 7-year-old daughter in the school holidays, and I'm actually going to do a class. I've got no idea what I'm like. Not a clue, because I didn't know what the level was. But the only class I really wanted to do was an advanced class of Elizabethan work. And for some reason, I was feeling very brave, and I enrolled in it. It was a 3-day class, and I absolutely loved it. And it sort of just went from there.
So it wasn't overwhelming at all. You were able to dig right in and get
No, I had that design 2/3 finished by the end of the class. I was
wow.
Yeah. I was really, really keen.
I guess. Oh, gee.
Yeah.
One of those.
Yes, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, so that because now I have the book, and I dabbled a little bit, but I just couldn't get connected. I mean, someday I want to, but it can look intimidating, and I'm sure it isn't once you dig in, but it's like so many things that they look like, oh, I could never do that. And then if you actually make an effort, it's not so bad. Yeah.
I mean, with most techniques, that's exactly the case. You know, if you learn it step by step and you do the basic stuff first, then it ends up not being that difficult. But if you look at it as a whole, it can be very overwhelming. So the key for teaching is to break it down into those little components. So it's just a natural progression of what you know into what you don't.
Yeah. So then you went on and got some formal education then. You got to get a couple diplomas here. I mean, you
well,
actually dug
I didn't,
in.
I didn't get them. The system that we have in New Zealand is that the national organization, which is ANZEG, they administer these certificates and diplomas, but it's completely self-directed. There are no classes. You can now get a mentor, but when I did them initially, there wasn't anything. So you get the syllabus and you take it home and you figure out your own way to do it. It's all self-directed.
Hmm.
So I did the surface stitch, the gold work and the needle lace ones in the early 2000s, sort of early to mid 2000s. And then I had a bit of a break and then went back and finished the rest of it to make the whole diploma, which was design and colour, I think, were the other ones I did. And then the Diploma of Embroidery Teaching was just an extension of that.
Yeah, Yeah.
I figured since I've got that far, I may as well keep going.
Yeah, why not? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. As you're learning these things, I mean, all kinds of techniques, you know, the message to people is you can't do it perfectly out of the gate. Tons and tons of hours of practice, I assume, to get yourself proficient at each of these techniques. A lot of work at that, or did it really come naturally to you across the board?
It comes reasonably naturally to me. But having said that, I can do more complicated things now than I used to be able to. I can do a lot finer, especially in things like the needle lace, reticella lace, that sort of thing. I couldn't have done it at the same scale when I first learned. Mm. But it is practice, but it's also that it does come relatively naturally. And that was part of why I'm a self-directed learner, because I don't need to practice over and over and over again to get something right. But if I can't get something right, then I will keep at it until I'm happy with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that does happen.
Yeah, I'm sure. I thought you were going to say something, Beth. Are you there, Beth?
Yes, I am here. Okay. Sorry. I've got a delay, so it's kind of hard. Sorry.
Oh, okay. Because, yeah, I wasn't sure what was happening there. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. That's quite all right. It's quite all right. Just wanted to make sure you got your questions in. Yeah. So.
Well, okay. I just wanted to ask you about the Castle Guidi. So you learned that here relatively recently, and then you've kind of taken it off.
Yes.
And its own little spin.
Yeah, I did. I first did it with Effie Mitrofanis from Australia. She came to New Zealand and taught a workshop. And traditional Castle Guidi is, generally speaking, monochrome. Ecru on ecru, or white on white, or very pale colours. And I did the design. I loved doing it, even though I had to do the counted stuff in the background. I desperately wanted to put color on it. So that tends to be what happens with me. I'll learn something, maybe something fairly traditional, and then I'll sort of subvert it to my own ends. And in the case of Casa Guidi, it was using color. But I don't like it when there's too much color. It's a fairly subtle use of color rather than a, let's see how many colors I can put on this thing, because I wanted to retain the nature of the embroidery. And I do keep going back to it. Every now and again, I'll have a break and then I'll go back and do some more. So it's something that keeps drawing me. I love the texture. I love the three-dimensional aspect of it. And I love playing around with the colors on it as well.
Yeah, and I've never, that's one of those techniques I don't know how to do. But it intrigues me because it does have all the texture, and what kind of throws me off is I'm like, okay, it's another white work, or, you know, very monochromatic. And I'm thinking, I want to add color to it. I want to add color. So when I saw yours, I was like, oh yes, I see. I see now. Cause you don't have a lot of color, but like you said, it's subtle. You use the texture of the stitch to an advantage.
Yeah. And in my case, normally I use variegated threads, but I mean, when you're doing, from what I can see, when you're doing counted work and you use variegated thread, you tend to just let the variegation do what it wants to do.
Mm-hmm.
But when I use it, you control it. So you look for the repetitions of color and you might line them up or use particular colors in one part and others in another part. So it makes it a little bit more cohesive. And you don't overuse it. I have seen some cases where it's been overused, and it's when I'm teaching, I call it, there's too much noise. You know, your brain can't make sense of it because there's just too much going on. So subtle use of it, even though I'd prefer the nice strong variegated threads, not the pale ones. It's enough to sort of give extra detail without overwhelming it.
All the techniques you have, is there a favorite? Do you lean toward one, or are they all just tools in a box that you grab when you need, depending on what's in your head for a design?
Yeah, I think more towards the second, that there are tools in a box. I have certain techniques I keep going back to, like the gold work, a Kasuguiri, and at the moment I'm on a needle lace bender where I can't seem to get enough of types of needle lace. And I tend to just let that run its course and then I'll move to something else. But I have a lot of variety in what I have produced, partly because I teach a regular class every week. And for that class, I have to come up with a new project once a term. So that's once every 12 weeks, I have to have a new project.
Ooh.
And my class don't want to just do gold work and Kasuguiri with a bit of needle lace. They want to do everything. So I've had to sort of throw myself into doing techniques that I'm not so familiar with. And sometimes that's led to a lot of other work. And sometimes it's been a one-off, gosh, that was fun, we won't do that again. they're very, very accommodating, and they're a bit like my guinea pigs because I can test a project with them and turn up and say, actually, I haven't quite finished designing this, not quite sure where it's going to end up. Let's just start and see what happens. They're very good at allowing me to do that.
Sounds like a great group of people to work with, but also the classic – if you want to really learn how to do something, try teaching it. And
yes,
yeah,
very much so.
Yeah, well, that's
about once every 2 years I do a counted work project just to make sure that they remember that I can do it, but it doesn't always come out the way that we want it to.
Do you do you keep up? I mean, stump work was kind of the catalyst. Is that something that you keep alive and keep active with? Because I got to believe that you need to stay after to remain proficient. Or maybe you don't, but.
Well, I haven't really. I did quite a lot of it to start off with, but I just do it every now and again. Often I will use things that are similar to stump work in other things. But no, I wouldn't say it's something that I regularly do, although I did teach it, taught a project, it was August through to about October this year. But with that one, we started it in class, and after 2 weeks we got completely locked down, so I had to finish that one remotely.
Yeah.
So that was quite interesting, sort of changing how it was done. But that's really the first stump work that I've taught in probably about 4 years.
Oh,
I guess.
Oh, okay. All right.
Hmm.
So what made you make the leap into business? Was it this class of people that you're teaching all the time that were kind of drove that, or did you, what is
no.
it?
No. Well, first of all, it's not actually my main thing that I do. I do have a 20-hour-a-week, or 15 to 20-hour-a-week part-time job as well. It's completely unrelated.
Yeah.
So I kind of juggle both. But I actually started as a business a long time ago, about 30 years ago, when I was making things to sell in craft stores. And we had an outlet called Craft World, which is like a permanent craft market. And I couldn't get suppliers because I wasn't an official business. So I thought, all right, then I'll be an official business. So I did all the legal stuff to become, registered. And so when I started, that was already established, although it was really just bubbling along, not doing anything very much. But when I started teaching and then realized that actually I could sell patterns and I could make kits and those sorts of things, it was a natural progression into it. So the old crafting stuff that fell by the wayside, and this has taken it over, but it's still not a fully fledged business. It's getting there. COVID sort of put a bit of a dampener on it.
Yeah.
Because of course everything just ground to a halt, and I didn't have the online things sorted out or anything like that. And I still don't completely. But it's where I want to go. So it's just, it'll just take me a bit longer to get there. That's all.
Yeah, the pandemic, it's done its damage in a lot of ways, yes.
Yes, it has.
Yeah.
Although it's amazing how things just bounce back afterwards.
Right.
we're just in that phase here where everything that was cancelled, or most of the things that were cancelled last year, are now being rebooked. So you sort of, it's almost like having your television on pause. Well, the pause button's come off again and off we go. So, but you, of course, you have to build things up. And I haven't done any selling events, for instance, for, 10 months. Ugh. Because there's just, everything was cancelled.
Yeah.
Right. And so are you finding that people are interested in doing like online classes?
I'm not sure. What I've done so far has been not so much an online class where it's live, because I don't have the technology to do that, but it's been more where you you do a set of instructions and there's a video that goes with it to do the bits that basically you would demonstrate if you were teaching in a class. So it's that I've experimented around with that quite a lot, and was very lucky that my daughter, who'd just finished a communications degree, was locked down at home, but had all these skills to edit videos, and she was able to do all that post-production stuff for me. So it's been quite good sort of playing around with that, but I feel it needs serious time to get it right. And I haven't got that serious time at the moment. I'm hoping to by not doing this other job for too much longer, but it hasn't quite got there yet.
It's nice to know that the money you invested in your child's schooling is going to pay off.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's good. So it sounds like you're at the cusp of making this a full-time effort then, if you can.
Yeah, that's sort of my aim to do that, but it's hard to know how practical that is, partly because of where we live. And I live somewhere where it's actually a very small population. So in order to grow the business, you've really got to go offshore. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, traveling offshore can't happen. And even sending things offshore is not very easy. From here, it seems to be almost impossible. So it's not the right time right now to be sort of looking that far ahead.
Yeah.
Have to wait for things to sort of calm down and get back to some sort of predictable pattern. I don't think we can use the word normal anymore.
No.
Because I don't know what normal is going to be, but at least predictable, so that you know this is what it is, this is what it costs, this is how long it takes, that sort of thing.
Right.
Yeah,
and when you guys do a lockdown, you don't mess around. It's complete.
No, we don't. This last one, it was 100 days.
Ooh.
Where the only time I went out was to go supermarket shopping, to the doctor, or to deliver groceries for my mother. That was it.
Ooh.
Wow.
And that's our major sort of lockdown levels. You don't do anything. Nothing's open. And you can't even, like when we were locked down that first, this time it was about 5 or 6 weeks, we weren't even allowed to send anything out. So we weren't allowed to post anything, unless it was essential services. So it meant that, for instance, I couldn't send kits to anybody because I wasn't allowed to. Huh. So it's a bit extreme, but that's what we had to do. So we're a pretty compliant lockdown here. So that's what we did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's probably saved a bunch of lives, so it's worth that.
Yeah.
So when that happens, does the design machine in your head start and you take advantage of the time to be creative, or is it just a chance to stitch?
Funnily enough, neither. I've found that a lot of it was getting these online things sorted, because each time we've been locked down, we've had classes cancelled and then tried to do some kind of alternative. And this last one, I sort of thought, no, actually, I'm going to do some playing. So I did a sketchbook challenge where for 30 days you drew in a sketchbook. And then for the next month or so, I played around with paints and jelly plates and just played with stuff rather than having specific things that I wanted to do. I've actually found that because our lockdowns are so strict that trying to do creative stuff is quite hard. You're just not in the right mindset for it.
Mm.
So playing was a better option. So I did that this time, and it was good. There's nothing much to show for it, but that doesn't matter.
No. So what did you think about the jelly plate? I use that. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I liked it, but I didn't have the right kind of paints, and I wasn't able to go out and get any. And even ordering them, they took 3 weeks to get there, which, you know, sort of the moment has passed a little bit. I had to make my own jelly plate. Mm-hmm. Again, just couldn't buy one. So the results are okay, but I don't feel I can control it enough yet to be happy with what I've done. But I quite like doing a print and then drawing on top of it, doodling on it, that sort of thing. Quite like that.
Right. And yeah. And I can see, because I'm thinking about doing that this really soon, is getting the jelly plate, printing on it on fabric, and then maybe taking it and stitching. And
I did a little bit of that.
Yeah.
Not the stitching part, just the printing on fabric. You just use a fabric medium, so it, mm-hmm. you know, that stays on it. But it prints almost as well on fabric as it does on paper. It's just a bit grainier. So you don't get quite the resolution, but if you're going to stitch on top of it, then that doesn't matter. You add that detail when you stitch.
Right. I just find it, to me, because I feel like the pandemic has kind of, I'm at the point where I'm like, okay, I don't feel as creative. And so the thought of pulling out my jelly plate and just playing with that is one way I think of spurring on my creativity.
Hmm. It worked for me. I think the key is to sort of switch off your logical brain. What is it? What am I going to do with it? You have to put that to one side and just do it.
Mm-hmm.
Just let it happen. So that you're not worried about, you know, if this one didn't turn out, well, turn the paper over and do another one. It doesn't matter.
Right. Cut it up. It'll be fine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Print over the top of it. Use it as wrapping paper. I mean, you know.
Collage fodder. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
The teaching is picking up now next year. Are you starting to see opportunities, or is it still, we'll schedule them, but don't hold your breath?
No, I've got quite a lot of bookings now for next year. Which hopefully will go ahead. We've just got to sort of plan that they will go ahead, but it's not as full as when before all of this happened.
Yeah.
I think the year 2019, I had something like 25 classes.
Wow.
Which mostly were weekends, so it was basically every second weekend I was away teaching. And I haven't gotten anywhere near that many scheduled. But that's probably a good thing, not a bad thing.
Is that okay with you, though, to have a lot of teaching? I mean, you enjoy it?
Yeah, I do. I really enjoy it. But you have to get some kind of balance, and it got a little bit out of balance. But with teaching, well, for me anyway, you never want to say no because they might not ask again. Mm-hmm. So you tend to, if they ask, you try and make it happen because – yeah, you just don't know if the opportunity will come up again.
Yeah, and the travel part of that is, before the pandemic, was traveling an awful lot. And it really, I always find that if people say, well, how do you feel about business travel? And my response is always, if I'm doing it regularly so I'm used to it, I don't mind it. It's when it's hit and miss and there's a whole bunch and then there's nothing for months that I don't like that, because you can't, like you say, you can't balance your time.
Mm.
And, if you're going every two, but then if you're going every other weekend, yeah, that can be quite a grind after a while.
Yeah, it can be. But of course, where I live, it only takes a day to get most places. Yeah. So you're not having to travel, three or four days to get somewhere. It's usually you can do your travel in a morning or in a day. it's unusual when it takes longer than that. So it's not too bad in terms of time.
Yeah. Materials. Go ahead, Beth.
So what are the international cruise classes like? That's the tour cruises. That one interested me. I was like, ooh, what's that like?
Yeah, it was really interesting. It was the Needlecraft Tours that they operate out of Sydney. Well, the cruises start from there, but they're from Australia, Maureen and Simon, who run them. And it's basically a conference. So the people sign up just like they would for a weekend conference. But instead of paying for accommodation in a motel, they're paying for a cruise and the needlework classes. And so you get on the ship and you do all the normal cruise ship things. But when you're at sea, that's when they do the classes. So the first one I did was Sydney to Singapore. And so we had 5 days cruising before we did any classes. It was all just cruise holiday, which was lovely. And then we were at sea for 2 days getting from, I think it was Brisbane to Airlie Beach or somewhere up the Queensland coast. And so we did 2 days worth of classes at that time. And then we had a bit more onshore holiday days and then some more classes. And then the trip from Darwin to Singapore, that was a 3 day class. So it just depends on the schedule as to where those classes fit in. But it's, you know, that when you're not doing the class, you're doing all the normal cruise passenger things. Okay. So it was interesting.
Yeah, I was just wondering how that worked, you know, because I was like, okay, so do you not do the cruise stuff? You just do stitch or so? Yeah, that sounds like it would be fun to try.
Yeah, well, on the days when you're in port, you go offshore, onshore. Yes, got to get this around the right way. You go onshore and you do what every other person on that cruise ship is doing. When you're at sea, we have the normal class times, but we take over the dining room. So you're sitting in these salubrious kind of environments and on one cruise with Frank Sinatra crooning nonstop every day, the same CD. That was interesting. But you have, it's like a normal class. You know, you start at 8:30, you stop for morning tea, you stop for lunch, except you go down to the smaller dining rooms for lunch or the buffet or whatever. You come back, you do your afternoon. And then at 4 o'clock, they throw us all out. The wait staff basically start making lots and lots of noise with their crockery and everything else because they need to set up for the dinner service. So we have to vacate rather quickly. And then the next day it starts all over again. And on long trips, like the second one I did was Sydney to Seattle. So we cruised around the Pacific Islands, Fiji and Hawaii, ended in Hawaii. But then there was another section that was from Hawaii to Seattle. Now, there were no classes on that section, but it was nearly a week. But they had a stitch and chat set up again in the dining room where you could go and you could stitch if you wanted to, all day if you wanted to. Or you could do all the other things on the cruise ship if you wanted to. There was no compulsion. So that was rather nice to be able to do that. The only real challenge I had is that I get really badly seasick. Oh. So that was my challenge to kind of work around, because you can't teach if you're throwing up in a bucket.
Yeah, that is a little difficult. Yeah.
We were pretty lucky on the first two. The weather was very, very good, had very little in the way of waves. The worst one was actually the one that we flew to Sydney, got on the cruise ship and sailed back to New Zealand. And the cruise was actually around New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And the passage from Sydney to New Zealand is not, it's not a calm piece of water ever.
Oh.
And so it was a bit rough, but but we managed.
Yeah. Yeah. Teaching when you don't feel well, not fun.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
No, that's too bad. Yeah. But those, I'm with you, Beth. That those cruises look intriguing because yeah, people do quite a few of them, and they look intriguing. I assume there's a half dozen or so teachers doing different things. Surely
20 teachers.
No,
it's big. Yeah, yeah. And each person that comes, they will do either two classes or three classes. Wow. And those classes can be quite big. For me, big is sort of 18, 20 people, or can be quite small with half a dozen. So it's a big group of people. It's not a little one. But it was fun. Yeah, I'm not sure whether at the moment a cruise ship somewhere where I'd want to go, but eventually no. probably would.
Not right now. But yeah.
it was a really interesting concept, and for me it was a way to connect with people outside of my own country, because most of the people on the cruise tend to be Australians on the needlework part of it. Some New Zealanders, but on the Sydney to Seattle one, we also had some Americans and some Canadians because we were ending up in Seattle. So it sort of made, you know, it made sense in terms of them getting home or whatever. But it was a good way to sort of just sort of see where you fitted in the international community rather than just at home.
Right.
So I thought, why not?
Well, there has to be a lot of value. If there's that many instructors there, there has to be an awful lot of value in just talking with them and collaborating. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, see, that's appealing. Fly to Australia and on a ship all the way back to Seattle. That wouldn't be too bad. Yeah.
It was about 20, gosh. It was more than 3 weeks. I think it was about 23 days.
Wow.
It was a long cruise. We had two stretches of a week at a time at sea. And I must admit, that was probably a little bit long for most people on the ship. But it's a long time to, you know, be sort of in one place. But it was a wonderful experience.
Think of all the stitching we could get done, Gary.
I know. I know. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sign me up. Yeah. Surely, do you eventually adapt and get over the seasickness, or is it just something that's with you the entire time?
Well, depends on, of course, the conditions. But when the conditions are reasonable, the first couple of days are a bit ropey. A bit of medication helps, and then you sort of get used to it.
Oh, okay.
But when you have to get off the ship, sometimes the ship can go straight into port and you get off onto the dock, but other times you have to go on the tenders. Now the tenders are actually the rescue boats. So they put them in the water and they take you to shore. And because the ships are big ships, I mean, the first two we went on capacity was about 5,500 people. The last one, it was one of these huge things. I think it was 7,000 people. Those ships can't get into all ports. They're just too big. And so you have to have these tenders to take you off. And those I find really difficult.
So here we go all over again.
Yeah. But that's temporary. You know, it's only going to be 20 minutes. So you can hold yourself together for that long usually. And just make sure you don't eat anything unwise before you go on.
Right.
On the boat. Right. It's always disastrous. Yeah.
Yeah. Now you've done some exhibitions. Do I have that right?
I have not done any solo exhibitions, so I've never done an exhibition where it was just me. I've done mostly group exhibitions or competition exhibitions. So every 2 years we have our national exhibition, which is also done at the same time as our conference, a national conference. We have regional ones every 2 years. We have other ones that are every year. So there's quite a lot of them. But I've only ever done one with one group that was sort of like a independent exhibition. Trying to get enough work together for an exhibition, I think, is beyond my capabilities at the moment, because it's a lot of time. You need to really work in a series and be quite dedicated to what you're doing, and with all the teaching that I'm doing, I can't do that.
Yeah.
But I usually try and enter any competitions that are going, because for me that's a spur to get something done, to do something on a topic that I wouldn't normally, you know, that sort of thing. So I find exhibitions very useful in that they push me to try things and get things done.
work harder at your stitching? Do you, when you're preparing for that, do you, is it a new level, or do you, are you comfortable at where you're at?
No. I'm a last minute finisher, I'm afraid. So sort of 1 week before the deadline, everything else just seems to stop, and the family, although it's only my husband now, but they have to feed themselves, and nothing else gets done. And I just keep going till I'm done. But that's, I've tried to be organized and do things ahead of time, and it doesn't work for me. I seem to need that last minute pressure to make decisions and trust my gut and just do it. Otherwise I tend to overthink things.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That makes you normal, I think, for most. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. What's your workspace like? Do you, people are always curious about the workspace. Do you have a room or a basement or something where you can set up?
No. I have a small office that holds all the paperwork, if you like, books and that sort of thing, and supplies. I have another bedroom that's been taken over, and that's basically a glorified storage cupboard that has most of the materials, and then the rest of the house becomes the workroom.
So you do have a building.
Yes.
Yeah, you have a building. Yeah.
Whole
okay.
House, yeah. Very large home.
House.
But I guess a dedicated space would be nice, but that's not been something that was within our capabilities to do. And I tend to just work where there's space, and try not make too much mess in the process.
So where do you teach your students?
Well, I don't teach them at home at all. I teach at a community house. That's the regular class, and the rest I go to wherever the students are. So a guild will ask me to teach for them, and they sort out the venue. That's not something I have anything to do with. I've done a little bit of teaching at home, but it's in my dining room, so that's not ideal. You really need a dedicated space for that, which I haven't got, so I don't do home-based classes at all.
Yeah, you need tabletops and places for people to spread out, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a really large table, good lighting, so what I've got is good, but I can only fit four people. You sort of need more than that if you're going to do regular classes.
Right.
Yeah.
So in the next year or two, loose plan then to grow your business and make it as full time as possible. That the general plan?
Yeah, that's the general plan. I'm not quite sure what form it will take, but that's the general idea.
Well, that sounds good to me. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, especially, because your work is different than what we see a lot here in the United States. So it would be, it'd be fabulous if we can, if you, for online or Zoom, or if you can get that figured out or expand that way, that would be, because I think that's the only one good thing we've said that's come out of the pandemic is people learning to go online with their needlework.
Yes.
And that's been fabulous for the average stitcher, because there's all of a sudden doors are being opened for them to see things that we hadn't been able to see before.
Yeah, I think that's very true. It's made that sort of thing a lot more doable, whereas before it would be like, oh, really? You want to do it online? Oh, no, I don't think that would work. Whereas we've had to make it work,
right,
in various forms. So, it's quite a big step to be producing something that is not for your home market. Partly because a lot of my designs are based on New Zealand motif and colors and all that sort of thing. So if you're going international, you have to think a little bit differently about what you're offering, because much as I would like, for instance, a Maori based Kasuguiri design, that's not something that has universal appeal. It's very localized.
I don't know. Let's.
I would. I would.
Yeah,
think
I don't
so.
know.
I would. I think you would, because you have, people that have traveled or say, oh, that reminds me of something I saw when I was traveling, or people that don't travel, who say, oh, that's someplace I'll never get to, but I love the colors, or, it would be, they'd find it appealing.
I guess so.
Yeah. See, to me, that's, to do something that comes from another part of the world, another culture. Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. That's appealing. Yeah. I don't know. Well, of course, Beth and I might just be weird too. I don't know. Yeah, I'd be for that. Yeah. Well, we'll just watch and then we can just order that way.
I mean, at the moment, it has to be, I think everything has to be digital, and it's got to be things that you can get where you are. And that's the other challenge at the moment, is that that's not an easy sort of hurdle to get over either.
No. Yeah. Right. Materials alone. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yep. All right, Shirley, this has been a treat. Thanks for making the time for us. Really enjoyed it.
You're welcome.
Yeah. And let's see, we have ShirleyPDesigns.co.nz is where we find Shirley. Be in the show notes, and you can enjoy all of her design work. So, all right. Thanks, Shirley, and thanks to everyone for listening.